you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, you.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It's my pleasure to have James Perloff back on the show. Of course, James is the author of the best-selling New World Order expose, Truth is a Lonely Warrior. He also is the author of Shadows of Power, an expose on the Council of Foreign Relations. And his website is jamesperloff.com. James, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. And by the way, congratulations on having your seventh child.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, seven, lucky number. There you go. You recently posted an article I thought was very interesting. The Extraordinary Censorship of It's a Wonderful Life, and how this movie was sort of snubbed at the Oscars of 1947 in favor of another movie, The Best Years of Our Lives, sort of a movie about the war, or at least the post-war, immediate post-war era in the United States. So, James, what motivated you to write this article?
Well, actually, in addition to the snub at the Oscars in 47, It's a Wonderful Life has been suppressed in recent years, and I've been annoyed by that, and I've tweeted on it, and I've made some just comments on my welcome page, but I felt it was about time to do a post on it. And It's a Wonderful Life, of course, a very uplifting film. In fact, the American Film Institute ranks it as the number one most inspiring movie of all time, and I'm assuming that most of the people in our listening audience have seen it. I first saw it in the early 70s when it was not considered a classic. It was just another film. And one time when I was in my early 20s, it happened to be on television. And at that time, I was a jaded hippie type guy and not a guy who would cry at the movies at all. But when that film started getting towards its climax, I was crying. And when it was over, I knew I'd seen a film that was quite extraordinary. It was not your typical Hollywood film. And I think a couple years later, I was watching with another hippie-type friend, and we were both trying to hold back our tears because, you know, we didn't want to look unmanly or anything, you know, crying over a movie. But it had that kind of effect. And by the 80s, it had really been discovered. It had become a Christmas classic. And I remember if you looked at the TV guide, every night there would be stations showing it. It was America's Christmas movie. In fact, this is interesting, Tim. After I published my article, a couple of people in the UK sent me individual emails pointing out an article in the BBC News stating that a poll showed that It's a Wonderful Life is Britain's favorite Christmas movie. Even in Britain, it has that. And, in the 80s, I took my father and my sister to the Coolidge Corner Theater to see it on the big screen. Coolidge Corner theater is in Brookline, Mass. It's a famous movie house that shows a lot of old classics. And this continued right into the 90s, this constant screening of this film, which really took American hearts by storm. And then something happened, which was in 1994, NBC acquired exclusive rights to the movie, and they immediately clamped this film like a vise. Nobody else could show it. Turner Classic Movies can't show it. You can't show it at the Coolidge Corner Theater anymore. Nobody but NBC can show it, and they show it once a year. I've heard some website articles that it's on twice a year. I don't know what the second time might be, but usually it's just Christmas Eve, and they riddle this thing, Tim, with so many commercials. I don't know what the percentage is, but towards the end of the movie, it seems like it's half commercials. And as the movie reaches its climax, which is pretty emotional, they put in so many commercials, which has all this modern stuff in it. It just totally takes you out of your involvement with the movie. And I remember one year my son said, let's forget this. And he stuffed a old VHS copy of the movie we had. We turned off NBC. It just didn't make any sense to watch it that way. They've ruined their own intellectual property, which one of the points I made in this post, it's my most recent blog post on jamesperloff.com, is that it doesn't make any sense, Tim, from a marketing or business perspective, when you've got a great property, to suppress it. If you've got a product that's in demand, whether it's a new energy drink or a new pair of running shoes or a new cell phone, that's iPhone, smartphone, you make more of them because it's in demand right now. Here you've got a movie that is in tremendous demand, and NBC doesn't want it shown. It doesn't want anybody else screening it. It doesn't want to lease out the rights. And of course, you could still download the movie and you could say that's their marketing strategy. But to market something, you got to get it out there and show people. And after, 25 years now since 94, the next generation is forgetting about this movie. And this last Christmas Eve, I was just curious, what's going on with This Wonderful Life. So I turned it on NBC. They didn't have it. And instead, at least here in New England anyway, they backdoored it onto NBC 10, which is a secondary NBC channel. So they're basically boiling the frog and moving this film out of public memory, which makes no sense for a film that is considered a true Christmas classic.
That's interesting. You contrast that with the network broadcast of Schindler's List. In the early 2000s, it ran commercial-free, uncut, on network television because it was so important.
That says something, doesn't it?
They don't want to ruin it with commercials, I guess, as they say. But I guess It's a Wonderful Life doesn't get the same consideration. No. Yeah,
absolutely not. And I believe this is deliberate, Tim. I just want to say that if you look at It's a Wonderful Life, there are, I think, three major reasons why the network wants it suppressed. And, back in the 80s, 90s, there was a thing called, I don't know if you ever saw it, it was called Movie Guide. It was edited by Ted Baer. It was a Christian guide to the movies. Mm-hmm. And they actually reviewed just about every movie that came out. But Ted Baer, periodically, he would run statistics that showed that family movies did much better at the box office than the Luciferian, R-rated, full of violence, full of swearing type movies. Yet Hollywood continued to make these really evil films that weren't doing well at the box office. He even gave the example of a film that lost $34 million. It's got $37 million to make, and it made $3 million at the box office. And the producers were asked about it. They didn't care. They wanted to make what they wanted to make. And the truth is, they always like to say, the bottom line is money. That really is not true in Hollywood. Money is important in Hollywood, but the real bottom line, and I think you can pick this up if you just watch the Oscars, it's ideology, and it's pushing certain politically correct messages. That's the real bottom line. And as far as It's a Wonderful Life goes, the three basic things that I see that they hate about this movie is, number one, the values in it. It's got the traditional family. It's got love and self-sacrifice in it, and it stresses the value of human life. And if you look at the not Supreme Court, the New York decision that was just made, the legalization of abortion up to birth, you can see that the powers that be, and you look at the statements they make about population control, Ted Turner and Robert McNamara and Prince Philip and the rest, what they say about human life, they obviously don't value it. And you know, the real message in the ending of It's a Wonderful Life is that life has value, right? That's one. And another is that it validates the existence of God. Now, it never makes a specific reference to Jesus Christ, but you know, it's got heaven, it's got angels, it's got prayer, it's got answers to prayer, and there's a lot of Christmas caroling in it. So there's a general Christian context. And the third thing that I think they really hate about it is that it's got an arch villain who's a banker, and he's one of the classic villains of all time, you know, Mr. Potter, the banker. Yeah. And he actually ruins, through his banking practices, the whole culture around him. And that comes up, of course, when George Bailey sees what life is like without him. And Mr. Potter's taken over the town. It's now called Pottersville. And you can see that the whole place is sick with, you know, it's in a state of moral sickness, you know, houses of prostitution and filthy movies, X-rated, what we now call X-rated movies.
Yeah, it's like Weimar Berlin or something.
Yeah, just exactly. Yeah, very, very good comparison, very apt. So I think those are the real reasons why this movie is being suppressed. It, like I said, it does not make sense from a marketing and business perspective to take a very popular product and take it out of the marketplace.
Yeah, yeah. You don't want positive messages being spread with these mm-hmm. movies. And at one time, even today, I guess there's some films that aren't, you know, evil, but the general tone in Hollywood and the whole mission of Hollywood is moral subversion, and a lot of that. And yet, it's a good point that it's not money is not the bottom line there, and we can see that now even with movies. I think the study you cited, I think used to be cited also by Michael Medved, the movie mm-hmm. reviewer, about
right.
why were these movies obviously if they took out the sexual content would have a much wider market, and even movies that weren't family related, if they just took out the sexual content, could have a wider market because people would be less guarded with them.
Right. I think there was a company, a man called Dove Films or something, where they actually took some quality films that had objectionable content, and they took out that content and repackaged it as a clean movie.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, when you look at a movie, and this is where a movie analysis or critique is very important, is the way movies from the point that the script is written, the scenes are planned out and shot, nothing is put in by accident or without serious consideration mm-hmm. or thought. So every scene has a purpose to it.
Right.
You know, every scene, sure. everything, whether who falls in love with whom and why and where they are and how you know, a character is portrayed is very important. And you're right about how this movie portrayed the banker as usurious and not caring about his community. You know, he wants to exploit people and these things, and you don't want that message being sent. You know, and especially now since the 2008 crash and these things. So,
mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you have movies now where, you mentioned Governor Cuomo. The Catholic governor of New York signing the bill that legalizes infanticide, more or less. More or less, he codifies. It's been going on for decades in the United States. But nevertheless, movies like, remember Cider House Rules with Michael Caine, that won Best Picture?
Oh, I forgot it won Best Picture, but yeah, I saw a few minutes of it and it was gross. Yeah, it was disgusting.
Heroic abortionists and these things. If you want to watch a pretty good analysis of that movie, there's a guy has a YouTube page called Blackpilled, and he does excellent movie analysis. He also did one on Pleasantville about how when the moment the people somehow get the two kids get transported back to 1950s. This takes place, from late 90s to 1950s, and they contrast the community, and the community is in black and white, and the moment the characters have illicit sex, they become colored. And they call it, and this is the introduction of revolution into the society, and you don't become alive again until you indulge in this stuff. And so, yeah, these movies are very important and in creating or directing the culture in often in subtle ways, you know.
Right. And actually, you know, I think it's been going on for a long time. You know, I remember having a conversation with a friend of mine. This is back in the 80s, right? And I said, you know, I prefer the old movies because they have the, you know, better values back then. Mm-hmm. You know, I prefer the, you know, stuff from the 50s and stuff. And he said, you know what? He said, Jim, even back in the old days, we were pushing the envelope. And it's true. If you actually look back at the older movies, you, not always, but usually they would be a little to the left of where the culture was, and they were always just edging it over because they couldn't do it overnight. They had to boil the frog.
Yeah, there's an interesting quote. This is obviously back in the old days during the production curve. This production curve lasted from roughly from the early 30s into the mid 60s. But the guy who ran the production code for about 20 years was a Catholic named Joseph Breen.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what he said about the Hollywood elite, and this was, I believe, in the 1930s. He goes, "They are simply a rotten bunch of vile people with no respect for anything beyond making of money. Here in Hollywood, we have paganism rampant and in its most virulent form. Drunkenness and debauchery are commonplace. Sexual perversion is rampant. Any number of our directors and stars are perverts. These Jews seem to think of nothing but money-making and sexual indulgence. The vilest kind of sin is a common indulgence hereabouts, and the men and women who engage in this sort of business are the men and women who decide what the film fare of the nation is to be. They and they alone make the decision. 95% of these folks are Jews of an Eastern European lineage. They are probably the scum of the earth." Now, he pointed out the ethnic component, which I think is still, well, probably more so today than it was in the 30s. And it is an important component to this, as sort of the subversive quality that many of, especially of those in power have, and the relationship they have towards, you know, middle America or the American public in general. They use the arts to subvert, and they do this to the seduction of the silver screen. And the promotion of celebrities in general has been a process of corruption. To use celebrities as sort of sort of a pantheon of the gods that we follow, you know, the celebrity worship that we can somehow, in many ways, hopefully emulate. And this is sort of this process of degeneration that we've been experiencing for the past, you know, 60, 70 years in this country. But that's from the 1930s. And I think he's essentially correct. We kind of blanch at the fact that he's identified a particular ethnic group, but I think most people, in a moment of candor and honesty, will admit that that's still a factor in what's being produced in Hollywood today.
Well, you know, Tim, I wrote a screenplay back in the 90s. It was optioned a couple of times, but they never were able to make it into a movie. But I heard a lady who was a famous script doctor in Hollywood, and this was a Christian content film. Mm-hmm. It was couched in a action mystery film plot. And one thing she said, you got to watch out, Jim. You got to remember that Hollywood is a Jewish town. And actually, look at just look at Wikipedia. Who founded the studios? Universal was founded by Carl. I don't know if I'm saying his name right. It's Lemley. He was Jewish. The Warner Brothers mm-hmm. were Jewish. William Fox, who started the Fox film, was Jewish. Joseph Schenck, 20th Century Fox, Jewish. If you go to MGM, it was Marcus Lowe, Sam Goldwyn, and Louis B. Mayer, all Jewish. Harry Kahn, Jewish, established Columbia Pictures. And Paramount Pictures came from Sam Goldwyn, Adolf Zukor, and Jesse Lasky, all Jewish. And it seemed like the only really big studio that was not Jewish was Walt Disney. But he was a 33rd degree Freemason, as I understand it. And so, you know, as you know, there were pretty well allied to the Zionists, the Masons, the high ranking ones. So, it's reasonable to say, and not an anti-Semitic comment. And by the way, I'm half Jewish myself. Mm-hmm. You know, the Perloff family, our name was Perloff, and we with a V, and we came from Russia in 1904. The family was Jewish, and so this is not said in any kind of racist or anti-Semitic context. It's just a fact that Hollywood, as a Jewish town, and has always had anti-Christian sentiments, but has only dared to do those to reveal those and to push those on a progressive step-by-step basis.
Yeah, and they played a key role in the in sort of the cultural Marxist. A lot of the cultural Marxists actually went out to Hollywood. Some went to universities like Columbia, but Herbert Marcuse went out to Hollywood, and they became the screenwriters, and they were going to sort of infect the culture that way. I mean, you can take movies like this, and this is interesting. It was a Philip Roth. Everyone talks about, well, you know, view of, you know, like White Christmas and Easter Parade, how Hollywood celebrating these Christian holidays. And this is what Philip Roth had to say about that. Of course, Irving Berlin, a Jewish composer, wrote White Christmas and Easter Parade. In Operation Shylock, Philip Roth claims he got his program for cultural perversion by listening to Irving Berlin. The radio was playing Easter Parade, and I thought, this is Jewish genius on a par with the Ten Commandments. God gave Moses the Ten Commandments and then gave us Berlin, Easter Parade, and White Christmas. The two holidays celebrate the divinity of Christ, the divinity that's at the very heart of the Jewish rejection of Christianity. And what does Irving Berlin brilliantly do? He de-Christs them. Easter, he turns into a fashion show, and Christmas into a holiday about snow. This shocklified Christianity is Christianity cleansed of Jew hatred. And so this is, again, that very subtle, very important. I mean, they can take Christmas and sort of denude it of all true transcendent meaning. And we have today a very commercialized Christmas, which doesn't obviously isn't as inspiring or as it might be otherwise, because now it's become so commercialized. And that's the criticism we have today of commercialized Christmas began back then with this type of entertainment fair.
Right. And I remember back in the 50s, when Christmas came around, my attention was always on, as it was of most American children, was what gift, what commercial product would my parents buy? And, of course, obviously preceded even my birth, because if you've seen The Christmas Story, you know that it thinks about, there's really no Christ in it. Occasionally you hear a Christmas carol being sung in the background or something, but it was all about the money. It was all about the products. However, it was all about sales. It was all about the cash register.
We have, however, It's a Wonderful Life, which, although it's only Christmas because the movie ends at Christmas. It's not, obviously, it's this person's life. It's much more about that. But back to It's a Wonderful Life, in the article, you cite a more, I guess, immediate concern of the ruling elite of America at the time, why It's a Wonderful Life is sort of pushed aside or ignored at the Academy Awards, and this other movie, Best Years of Our Lives, is promoted. And you have an interesting theory on that?
You know, when I was a young, you know, I was a hippie in the 70s, and then I by 78, I'd abandoned my ways, and I joined the John Birch Society, and I started becoming a hardcore anti-communist, which I still am. I read one conservative writer saying that the Best Years of Our Lives had really attacked the Americanist movement. And I thought, I think I had seen that movie. And I said, I got to watch it again and see what the guy was talking about. And so in my current article on my blog, jamesperloff.com, about the suppression of It's a Wonderful Life, I do have a key clip. And I don't own the rights to the film, obviously, but somebody else had posted that clip on YouTube, so I thought I'll put it in there. And the clip is this. The film, the background of the film is about three GIs, three soldiers returning from the war. One is Dana Andrews, played by Dana Andrews, and one is played by Frederick March, and one was an unknown actor, Harold Russell. Again, this is the guy who really did lose his hands during the war in an accident. And he has two prostheses, substitute hands that he uses very skillfully in the film. And he's a very sympathetic, real life person who I believe he very much deserved the Oscar. But the other Oscars, you know, the film won 7 Oscars in all told, and It's a Wonderful Life won 0. So for the most inspiring film of all time, that doesn't make a lot of sense. And I think one of the things they pointed out in the post was that quite often it's not the main plot that they really want you to absorb. It's rather the little scenes that they toss in on the side, the subtext that they want you to get. And this had more than one in it. And one of these, and this is the clip you can actually watch, it's on YouTube, and I link to it from this blog post, is there's this drugstore scene where Dana Andrews is the guy behind the soda fountain. and coming up to the counter is Harold Russell, the guy who's lost his hands during the war. And they have a friendly conversation, and then this stranger comes in, and he asks Harold Russell how he lost his hands, and then he says, how terrible that was, and he says that it was too bad, it was all for nothing, you know. And so Harold Russell says, what do you mean for nothing? And then basically this guy gives sort of a very perverted view of what the revisionist view was of World War II. Harold Russell actually puts words in the guy's mouth. He kind of makes a straw man. He says, oh, you mean we should have been on the side of the Japs and the Nazis, eh? We're all suckers, eh? Even the guy didn't actually use those terms. But that's the audience now sees Harold Russell getting into a fight with this guy. And, of course, they're naturally all their sympathy is going to be with a guy who's lost his hands, right? Yeah. And to make this guy even more repulsive, when Dana Andrews tells him, you know, you better pay your check, buddy, the guy says, and that's another thing, every soda jerk in this country thinks he's somebody. So he's made out to be this elitist. And finally, Harold Russell, the man with no hands, gets into a fist fight with a guy. So Dana Andrews heroically jumps over the counter, punches the guy in the face. He goes flying backwards and smashes into a glass counter, which shatters into dozens or maybe even hundreds of glass fragments. And then the boss comes up and asks what happened. And Dana Andrews says, well, I know I'm fired because the customer is always right, but this customer wasn't right. And he throws off his smock and he quits his job, right? So the message was that if you question the war, this is what's going to happen. You're going to be punched in the face and you're going to fly backwards. And there's some things that were actually going on in terms of suppressing revisionism. But let me throw this back to you, Tim, for your comment.
Yeah, it is interesting. First thing is, supposedly you fight a war for freedom, yet this guy's set upon just for expressing his opinion.
Right. Exactly. It's a real thing. Yeah. You can't say what you think. Yeah, in this country. You know. Even though we just fought a war about freedom of speech, right? Freedom of, you know, to do what you want to do, right?
Yeah, America, love it or leave it, right? The portray him as an elitist with that remark about, you know, every soda jerk thinks he's somebody. Well, the irony is that really, if you look at I guess he would have been an American Firster. The American First Committee was sort of this middle American. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it started at Yale Law School, these things. Really, its support came from middle America. And
right.
It wasn't elitist thought. In fact, it was the East Coast elite, the coastal elites that were baying for war in 1940-41. So it's complete, you know, inversion of reality. It was a little guy who, you know, had nothing really at stake. You know, they weren't invested. They weren't invested internationally, nor were they linked to the British Empire in these things. Yet, you know, it's portrayed as somehow as an elitist opinion to try to avoid getting into the war when it's the exact opposite. So,
right. In fact, it was the J.P. Morgan interest that got Wendell Willkie into the position to run as a Republican candidate. He was the only pro-war Republican candidate. The rest were all against getting involved with the war. And you're quite right. The Gallup poll showed well over 80% of Americans. So the bulk of Americans were against getting involved with the European war until the contrived Pearl Harbor event came about.
Yeah, and you write about how contrived it was, this you know, sort of a setup provoking the Japanese and kind of leaving everyone vulnerable to be attacked to open the back door to war is what the war in the Pacific was, because Hitler had refused to take a bait in the Battle of the Atlantic in 1941. You know,
right.
with the various provocations like the Reuben, I guess it was what the Reuben James and what the other incident. You write about how Charles Beard talks about how the suppression of criticism of America's entry into the war, the same thing that they wanted to prevent what occurred after the First World War. In the 1920s, there was sort of this, I guess, general recognition that we'd been had, and people felt alienated and conned, and the corruption, and they didn't want the same thing occurring in 1946 that occurred in 1920.
That's exactly right. And so let me quote Charles Beard, who was the former president of the American Historical Association. I mean, he wrote these words in an editorial for the Saturday Evening Post. Now, this was 1947 he wrote this, which is the same year that the Best Picture Oscar went to the Best Years of Our Lives. And here's what he wrote, quote, "The Rockefeller Foundation and the Council on Foreign Relations intend to prevent, if they can, a repetition of what they call the debunking journalistic campaign following World War I. Translated into precise English, this means that the Foundation and the Council do not want journalists or any other persons to examine too closely or criticize too freely the official propaganda and statements relative to our basic aims and activities during World War II. In short, they hope that the policies and measures of Franklin D. Roosevelt will escape in coming years the critical analysis, evaluation, an exposition, sounds like the 9/11 truth movement, right? That befell the policies and measures of President Woodrow Wilson and the Entente allies after World War One, end quote, Dr. Charles Beard. And what he's talking about here is that after World War One, as you were already touching on, Tim, they found out that the Lusitania was a setup. That was the main event that got us into the war. But the Lusitania was carrying, so let's see if I can do this from memory, 173 tons of rifle cartridges, 46 tons of aluminum powder, a dangerous military explosive, 50 tons of shrapnel shells, 18 cases of mercury fulminate, and many, many tons of gun cotton, which is another military explosive, which was against the law. And Senator Bob La Follette pointed out in a speech in 1917 to the public, and it was also brought out that the war was supposed to be all about national self-determination. Well, the British stole about 1 million square miles of land as spoils of that war. Also, soldiers were dying, getting paid $30 a month, while the banksters, the industrialists, actually stole $6 billion from the American taxpayers for munitions that they never delivered to the front. They just refolded that money back into their own companies. And that was brought out in a 21-volume report that took 3 years to accumulate by the Graham Committee of Congress. But there's not even an entry for the Graham Committee of Congress in Wikipedia. It's forgotten. And none of those industrialists, they handed down indictments, but they were all quashed. None of them went to jail for that. Also, the war was supposed to be the war to end all wars. It failed drastically. And it was going to make the world safe for democracy. And look what happened to democracy. The Bolsheviks took over Russia and murdered 60 million people. So much for making the world safe for democracy, right? It had been debunked thoroughly. Oh, and the atrocity stories about the Germans cutting off the hands of Belgian children. People investigated that and found it was all bunk. It was all just war propaganda. It never happened. So World War One had been totally debunked, and they were determined, the Council on Foreign Relations and the Rockefeller Foundation, this was not going to happen, and they were going to ruthlessly suppress anyone who came out and tried to analyze the war. Now, what the guy in the drugstore scene would have really pointed out, he wouldn't have said, oh, you guys are a bunch of suckers for losing your hands in the war. He would have pointed out that Roosevelt knew about Pearl Harbor in advance but did not warn our commanders in Hawaii, and that was established in 1944 by the Naval Court of Inquiry and the Army Pearl Harbor Board by testimony of officers from the Army and Navy. It was also established in testimony before the Congressional Inquiry into Pearl Harbor in 1945 and 46. And it was beautifully laid out in the book Pearl Harbor, the Story of the Secret War by reporter for the George Morgenstern, the reporter for the Chicago Tribune. Also, the fact that Germany never had any plans to conquer the world. This was acknowledged by our own chief of staff, General George Marshall, and has been validated since then because no document has ever been found in any archive indicating that Germany had plans to conquer the world. All of this is the kind of stuff a real revisionist would have been talking about in the drugstore. But of course, none of that was brought out in the movie. They just make him out to be this evil guy who wants to be on the side of the Japs and the Nazis, you know. Mm-hmm. But this is what real revisionism was about. But the movie, The Best Years of Our Lives, was an expression of the suppression of that free speech and investigation into our war motives that Dr. Charles Beard was discussing.
Yeah, and Dr. Charles Beard also talked, I think he was the one that approached in the earlier part of the 20th century, when I believe the Carnegie Foundation sought to buy out the historical profession or discipline, and they started the American Historical Association, mm-hmm. and I think they approached him to say that if he were to offer up an interpretation of history that was congenial to their long-term plans. And he said he would not, and they said, that's no bother, we'll just endow chairs and dole out benefits, and pretty soon we'll have our own generation of historians that will do this, and they have done that. So it's interesting that he would write, in, you know, right after the war about this CFR plot, if you will. The only people who really had plans to take over the world in 1946 was the CFR, probably.
Right, the global government. The global government. Yeah.
Which actually included the Soviet Union, because the Soviet Union was part of that dialectic, and that gets them more of the meta level of what was going on at the time, because Bolshevism itself was imported into Russia from the West. It's interesting how the CFR would talk about they would not tolerate any of this, as Dr. Beard writes about. Is this gives you an indication how it's done, and this is why we're seeing movies in Hollywood, why some movies are promoted or given awards and others aren't, and produced and these things. It's because the CFR, if you look at how the CFR operates, they, in, among their membership, will not only will they provide staff for the State Department, for then burgeoning Central Intelligence Agency and other U.S. government agencies, advisors to the president's secretary of state. They'll also include journalists. They'll also, you know, people like probably Drew Pearson or Walter Winchell at the time. I'm not sure if they were members, but this is an example. I'm sure they were influenced by them, because judging from what they did, you know, did for them. But they would include, we see today, even today, journalists, you know, whether it's Tom Brokaw or an actress like Angelina Jolie, or a movie producer, they're members of the CFR too. So this type of controlled information, controlled narrative, would be coordinated through the CFR through a series of concentric circles. Because all these, although these Hollywood may seem separate from the State Department or CIA or the Pentagon, it's all coordinated behind the scenes by an outfit like the CFR, because they all meet and they coordinate to promote, you know, this one agenda, you know, which is, you know, the globalist world government agenda. And then we see it with Hollywood today. With Hollywood, is, when we say Hollywood is run by Jews, well, that's kind of true, but it's also in league with the CIA and the Pentagon, you know, and the Zionist, Anglo-Zio Empire, and these various factions. They're all part of this crime syndicate that seems to be running the show.
Right, and of course, the Council on Foreign Relations, always run by bankers, you know. Chairman for a long time was John McCloy, who was also chairman of Chase Manhattan, and then David Rockefeller.
Wasn't he also governor? Didn't he also like run post-war Germany too?
Yes, he did.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah, and he was very heavily involved with the Marshall Plan, which was all involved with
which was the CFR,
know, NATO,
which was a CFR plan.
Yeah, it was definitely a CFR plan, and the idea to create an Atlantic Union, a transatlantic union, which would be, you know, stepping stone towards world government. Mm-hmm. But it's always been the bankers. David Rockefeller was honorary chairman after being the real chairman up until his death at the age of 101, and then until recently, the co-chairs of the Council on Foreign Relations were Robert Rubin of Goldman Sachs, mm-hmm. and Carla Hills of J.P. Morgan Chase. And now the chair is David Rubenstein, CEO of the Carlyle Group. And vice chairman is Jamie Mischik. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that right, of Kissinger, CEO of Kissinger Associates. I mean, yeah, so the bankers bankroll Hollywood, and they're going to bankroll the policies that they are pursuing. And have those advanced. And Hollywood's been doing that for years. You know, you know, another historical example that I like to give, you know, a lot of people are familiar with how the movie Pearl Harbor came out in 2001 after, you know, the call for a new Pearl Harbor. Mm-hmm. Then, of course, we had the real Pearl Harbor in September of 2001. But if you go back to the actual Pearl Harbor of 1941, you know, less than 2 months before that event occurred, a movie came out for which the actor was awarded the best Oscar for the best actor, and that was Sergeant York, starring Gary Cooper. And if you've ever seen that film, released, I think it was September of 1941, Gary Cooper played Sergeant York, and how he's very religious, and he's got I think it's a pastor played by Walter Brennan, who advises him to go ahead and enlist. And he's very reluctant based on religious principles to enlist. But then he comes back a war hero, not disabled or anything, comes back a war hero. And that movie was all about encouraging guys to enlist. And not a coincidence that it came out right before Pearl Harbor any more than the movie made by Touchstone Pictures in 2001 with Ben Affleck came out in May of 2001, right before 9/11. I'm sure the Hollywood guys themselves probably don't know the details of the event that's about to happen, that would be classified, but they are told what type of movie to make and what kind of sentiment to generate amongst the American public.
Yeah, in Hollywood in the 40s was pretty much being run, at least it was heavily influenced by British intelligence. The Quarter Circle, William Stevenson and these things. So there's there was that influence there to direct the movies. I think Gore Vidal writes about that. And you had Casablanca come out, which I think came out after we had entered the war, 1942, but it had been produced before our entry. And all that is about the sort of this, Rick is, of course, is a, he's neutral, right? But he's forced to get involved, to do the right thing, and get involved in the war. And he's cynical, but then, I guess his better angels prevail and he gets involved in the fight. And that's what the whole message of that war, of that movie, is how it's essential for Americans to get into the fight.
I've made a meme about that movie on for Twitter, where Claude Rains, the French Vichy police officer, he says to his officers, "No, don't round up the usual suspects. Arrest this guy, playing Humphrey Bogart." It says, "Don't you know what America is eventually going to do to the Middle East?" Speaking of the British, by the way, and their influence on Hollywood. I don't know if you ever saw the film The Four Feathers. It was a Hollywood, British stupendous war classic. It came out 1 month before the start of World War One in 1939, and is about a officer who backs out of the military service out of cowardice, and his friends send him feathers, white feathers, which represent cowardice, but then he goes and he fights on his own and he becomes a hero, right?
Well, that's funny, because white feathers, isn't that what the women were passing out to soldiers in World War One for people who didn't enlist before the British was ordered?
I believe that was perhaps the origin of it, and that would explain the title of the movie. But again, that was the British on their own part encouraging and pressuring their own people to enlist to fight in the war just 1 month before it actually happened. So British... the British version of Hollywood had their own tip-off on what kind of film to make before the event happened.
This is sort of meme warfare. I mean, we see this now, although it's not a war issue. You talk about Hollywood not really caring about money, because at the end of the day, the oligarchs who control Hollywood are probably connected to the bankers that actually control the money. So money's just their way, maybe a form of accounting, but they're not really constrained by the same rules that we are when it comes to money, because there's the endless black budget. Part of the reason why the CIA is so involved in drug trafficking is because it allows them to access billions of dollars of black off the books funding. And so some of this may go into, people who've done work about Hollywood connection, the mafia, these things, the ethnic mafia that runs Hollywood, is that a lot of these movies are used to launder drug money. Most famous is like the Blues Brothers and things like that. But I think even some of the B-run movies, there's a reason why you have so many sequels. It's a way to launder drug money because you can engage in a creative accounting and things. But I think there's also a geopolitical cultural aspect to here where, we obviously were aware of the liaising between CIA and Hollywood and the Pentagon, and how much has been written in the past 10 years about how they influence the script and stories and these things. But it's gone on much longer than that. I mean, after all, Disney Studios were seized by the War Department in 1941. There's a reason why Donald Duck was enlisted to tell everyone to pay their taxes and these things. So it's a long standing thing. I forgot what my original point was.
I thought it was interesting you were talking about creative accounting. Apparently, Mel Brooks, the producers, was not the only example of creative accounting. Yeah. I actually did not know about Hollywood's role in drug laundering. That doesn't surprise me. Yeah. But imagine you must have had some guests on. I don't know if you had Jay Dyer on. Who provide insights into some of these other aspects of
the most famous is that when with the Cotton Club murders and these things, and that was cocaine money, and that's kind of well known. That actually ties links into the Son of Sam story and all. That's a very twisted story. But the idea is that the original point is that really they if there's a cultural there's a reason why Disney could fork out $200 million on Pentagon, not really worry about being a loss, right? Because there's a bigger agenda here. When they made that, they really didn't care that it bombed, and you can tell because not much effort was made to make it a good movie.
Pearl Harbor,
yeah, I mean it was, but it was an awful movie. But because there's a cultural, the geopolitical culture agenda here is they don't care if they lose money in these things now, and that's some of these movies. A good example is this latest Fiat, the controversy regarding the Gillette ad about toxic masculinity. You know, people say, why would they insult their customer? They don't care. It's a huge corporation. It's tied into the New World Order anyway, probably one way. So they can lose money on it. But right now, they're more concerned in the culture in general. Corporations aren't just money-making operations. Yeah, there's that. But there's also corporations are now being used to mold and shape culture, same way Hollywood is now. And Hollywood is more direct because it's entertainment. And most people get their idea of the world or history through entertainment and movies and these things, they're pushing this agenda of toxic masculinity to destroy male authority, particularly white male authority, for several reasons in these ads. So they don't care, so to boycott it is useless because that's really not why they're doing it. They're not doing it to sell more razors or products. They're doing it to shape the culture, and corporations are a roundabout way of doing it, other than overt government, psychological warfare or brainwashing, because they'll do it through terms of service. They'll do it through human resource policies, making everyone take sensitivity training courses and these things, make everyone comply. So gradually through the years, people just start to internalize these beliefs and these presumptions. And we have a society we have today, right?
Yeah. Right. And there's one reason why they consolidate businesses through mergers. Mm-hmm. Take a famous example from the banking industry. I'm sure I've probably mentioned your show before, but the Warburgs ran the Manhattan Bank and the Rockefellers ran the Chase Bank. They became Chase Manhattan. Then Chase Manhattan merged with J.P. Morgan, became J.P. Morgan Chase. And then they absorbed Bank One and I think Bear Stearns. And, when you consolidate corporations, of course, you consolidate policy. And that's the same idea with consolidating nations and even religions, is that like with the EU, you make EU conformed with standard policy on abortion, et cetera, make everybody conform and get a single agenda, a monolithic agenda being advanced upon the people. And so you really see the New World Order taking shape politically, religiously, in the banking and in the corporate spheres in order to really enslave us. And, just a few voices for truth speaking out. And, of course, I've even been hearing this week on Twitter about YouTube announcing that it's going to suppress anything calling itself a conspiracy video or labeled as a conspiracy video. And you don't know, how long will it be before they completely shut out the alternative voices. But it's great to actually have an opportunity still now to speak the truth.
They post like disclaimers now. If you have like a show on 9/11, they'll post like the Wikipedia version of 9/11 or the JFK assassination. And it's so superficial. It's so stupid. I mean, it's like no one's, now I'm not going to listen to what these people are saying because of this post here. And it's a pathetic attempt to suppress any the truth or any, speculation or investigation into the real events of the the true stories behind these events. You talk about consolidation and control, and that's one thing that they get with if they pretty much create a situation where the whole world is one big company store, and if you don't comply, you'll lose your Prime membership for Amazon or something, so you can't buy anything anymore after they shut down all the retail stores.
Yeah, you can really see it taking. I'm convinced that Amazon's purpose was to destroy retail competition, and Amazon started out as a very free market, but now they're suppressing politically incorrect books.
Yeah, like YouTube,
on a,
yeah.
a limited scale. And even my own book, Truth of the Lonely Warrior, was suspended for a while about a year ago, and I got it back up there. But you can see, you know, once you get a monopoly, of course, then you're in a position to really control the messages. You know, Tim, I wanted to just get back to It's a Wonderful Life for mm-hmm. a minute, since we kind of started on that topic. And I wanted to mention a couple of things. One is, one of the things is Jimmy Stewart. he gave the performance of his life in that film. It was really, he'd just gotten out of the war himself, you know, and he gave a really emotional performance that I think was close to second to none. And he did get nominated, but did not win. And this is just more about the politicization of the Oscars. The best Oscar award went in 1947 to Frederick March for Best Years of Her Life. Best Years of Our Lives. And I was looking at that and examining it because, you know, again, it was about three GIs coming back home. And obviously Harold Russell, without hands, was facing big problems. And Dana Andrews, the second GI, he has a lot of problems. His wife cheats on him. He's got PTSD. He's got nightmares about the war. And he can't get a good job. That's why he's working as a soda mm-hmm. jerk. But if you look at the guy who won the Best Actor Oscar, Frederick March, he doesn't face any problems at all in the film. He comes back to a beautiful, wealthy home. He's got a beautiful, loyal wife played by Myrna Loy. He's got two beautiful children. He immediately gets his job back at the bank with a promotion, and he doesn't face any hardships or challenges during the whole film. And, he gets the only negative he really faces in the film is that his daughter falls in love with Dan Andrews, who's married, so he warns them to stay away from each other, but that's not, you know, Oscar worthy. But the reason I believe he got that Oscar has to do with the banking industry. And he plays a banker, and there's a scene in there, again, superficial scene, but he's in charge of the loan department. And he meets this soldier returned from the war who looks kind of like Fess Parker, very honorable young man. He says, I'm a farmer, and my father was a farmer before me, and I just want to have my own farm for me and my wife and my four young'uns to live on. And so, Frederick March, you see this guy's got great character, and he proves the loan. Well, his boss, who's at the bank, Frederick March's boss, is played by Ray Collins, who later was best known on as Lieutenant Tregg on Perry Mason. He's very angry that at Frederick March for approving this loan because that guy didn't have any collateral, which it doesn't really make any sense because, first of all, even they say in the movie that the bank is half that the loan is half guaranteed by the government, and bankers love taxpayer guaranteed loans. Mm-hmm. They just love them. And also, to say that the guy had no collateral is nonsense because the farm is his collateral. If he falls behind his interest payments, the bank is going to take over the farm and kick out the farmer and his wife and his four youngins and sell the farm yeah. probably for a nice profit. So there's no drama here at all. But later, Frederick March gets drunk at a company dinner, and he gives this drunken speech about how we wouldn't have won the war if we demanded having enough collateral. It doesn't really make any sense. But somehow the guy got the Oscar up against Jimmy Stewart, who gave the performance of his life. And he also had some other tough competition. You know, it was Sir Laurence Olivier and Henry V, which I haven't seen. But, you know, you got to know a young Laurence Olivier would be a tough competitor. And also Tyrone Power in a pretty good film, The Razor's Edge. And I'm sure Frederick March, who did not even show up for the 47 Oscars, was pretty shocked when he got the best Oscar. But when I looked at this, Tim, I looked at this and I think that the banking system, which again, they bankroll Hollywood, was looking at the fact that millions of GIs were returning after, you know, 2-3 years of absence. And they wanted to get them all into the debt system. They wanted these guys taking out 30-year mortgages and paying interest for the rest of their lives. And so Frederick March's whole role was to promote giving loans to GIs, giving loans to people. That was his big, big moment.
Oh, yeah.
Film, and so they wanted to get these GIs into debt.
Yeah, they want the financing for Levittown.
Yeah.
And suburbia,
So I think that's right there in a nutshell is why this sort of it was a non-part. It was sort of a non-role. Again, he doesn't face any challenges in the film. There was nothing Oscar-worthy about it, but he got the Oscar basically for promoting debt and usury.
Yeah.
And Jimmy Stewart gave that wonderful performance and was ignored. And again, It's a Wonderful Life did not get a single Oscar nod. I don't know if we should go into it or not, given the time. Some people said that Frank Capra should have released It's a Wonderful Life a year later, and he would have had a better chance of getting the Oscar in 47. But I happen to know, because I've written an article all about the best Oscar winner of 1947, that there was another film that was guaranteed the Oscar in 1947. And so it would not have done it any good if it had waited for another year.
Yeah, that would have been Gentleman's Agreement, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which was a movie about anti-Semitism. Of course, that's the critical year that the Israeli state is established.
Right. Yeah. The Oscar ceremony that year was, of course, in 1948, March of 1948. And less than 2 months later, the State of Israel was proclaimed. And 11 minutes later, Harry Truman, who, according to John F. Kennedy, received a $2 million bribe from Abraham Feinberg, the founder of AIPAC. 11 minutes after Israel was proclaimed, the United States recognized it. But that ceremony, giving the, when I was a teenager, when I was about 16, my father and I were watching television. This is back in the 60s, and the TV station announced, you know, this coming Friday or whatever the day was, we'll be showing the winner of the Best Picture Oscar for 1947, Gentleman's Agreement. And we thought, wow, this must be great entertainment. We're really looking forward to it. We figured, you know, something like Lawrence of Arabia or On the Waterfront, you know, a great movie, great entertainment. And the film was so boring. The whole thing was one long lecture about anti-Semitism, which we had nothing against. My father was Jewish. There's nothing wrong with being against anti-Semitism, but the plot was dull. It was all dialogue, no action, no humor. And they tacked on a romance just for the sake of having a romance. And even Gregory Peck, who played the lead, said that the romance had absolutely no magic between him and Dorothy McGuire. It was just for the sake of having a romance. But the whole thing is Gregory Peck plays a magazine writer who writes he's assigned to write a series on anti-Semitism. And so he pretends to be Jewish. And he finds anti-Semitism around every corner. His janitor, his secretary, his doctor, and even his new girlfriend, Dorothy McGuire, all subtly express anti-Semitism. And then he lectures them about bigotry. And that's the whole film, is him encountering anti-Semitism in a subtle way and then lecturing them. The real tragedy, though, of 1948 was not Gregory Peck failing to get reservations at an upper-class hotel because they thought he was Jewish. The real tragedy of 1948 was the Nabka and 750,000 Arabs being driven from their homes, 531 Arab towns destroyed, massacre after massacre taking place in Palestine, which was not even known to the American public, yet the Oscar went over this, I can't even call it a tearjerker. My father and I were making jokes by the end of the film. It was so boring. We just couldn't believe it had won the Best Picture Oscar. And so to me, it was always a mystery why such a poor film won the Best Picture Oscar. And then it became clear to me as I wrote on Geopolitics that it was 2 months before the recognition of Israel, and they wanted to squash any criticism of that, because anyone who criticized that would be labeled anti-Semite. And that's why that film won the Oscar. And that's why It's a Wonderful Life still would not have won the Best Oscar of 1947 if they delayed the release of the film, because it was all guaranteed. It was in the bag for Gentleman's Agreement.
Yeah, that's a critical period, because I think it's in Benjamin Ginsberg's book, The Fatal Embrace, Jews in the State, I think is the title of the book. But he writes about how at that time, the late 40s, early 50s, the Jewish powers organizations were coordinating a policy called dynamic silence. And what they would effectively boycott any radio station, newspaper that allowed criticism of what was going on in Palestine at the time. And those journalists and those figures who called out who were critical of this found themselves, without a career, without a job. A good example is Dorothy Thompson, I think was her name, a lady journalist, who was very critical of the Third Reich, actually, during the war. And she actually was championing Jewish interest during the war and their treatment at the hands of the Germans. But she got word what was going on in Palestine with the various massacres and these things and the sort of fait accompli that was being visited upon the Palestinian people at the time, the people that lived there. And she found herself, although she was a very celebrated journalist, had columns and had a nationwide radio show, she found herself completely ostracized for this. Of course, you also have the deaths of James Forrestal, which some people link back to his opposition to the America, United States recognizing Israel, why he apparently jumped out the window at the National Institute of Health, the 16th floor. And there are some reports that he actually received a threat from Bernard Baruch and Lyndon Johnson just prior to his death, not to take a position that might not be good for his health. they were playing dirty and they were very serious about it. And I think the story with Truman was he was offered either gold or lead, and he took the gold, you know. And people don't hear about the various, the massacres, the Stern Gang, the Jewish terrorists, and these things, and also the vast Jewish criminal network, the Jewish mafia, how they were mobilized in supplying the arms and the weaponry that was necessary for the victory of the Jewish forces, the Zionist forces in Palestine. And no one has ever prosecuted for this. I think Hank Greenspun, who was the editor of the newspaper in Las Vegas, was a proud Zionist who was fined for it, like $70,000, but I think he made like $1 million off all the illegal arms shipments that occurred. But this involved folks like Meyer Lansky in this, but it's very little was written about it or talked about. It's now acknowledged as heroic by AIPAC and these Jewish organizations. I think who is the Hollywood producer who got a medal for his efforts in supporting Jewish, I guess, espionage in this.
Milken?
Arnold Milken, yeah.
It was behind quite a few famous films, including JFK.
Arnold Milken, yeah.
Yeah.
He's got a medal for it, for spying against this country, you know.
Exactly, and I was just going to mention, I think Harry Truman's most famous phrase might have been "the buck stops here." And when I learned about him receiving a $2 million bribe, I said, "Yeah, $2 million stopped right there." it only took him 11 minutes to recognize Israel, which shows the how American presidents were genuflecting before the bankers. As early as the State of Israel was created, of course, you mentioned Lyndon Johnson. Of course, we all know that he started the escalation of the Vietnam War over a non-existent attack on a U.S. destroyer in the Tonkin Gulf, which resulted in 58,000 GI deaths. Yet when we were really attacked at the on the USS Liberty in 67, he did absolutely nothing and did everything he could to suppress that, even though there were 34 American dead and over 170 wounded.
Yes, and he was having an affair with a Israeli agent.
Right, correct, at the exact same time.
Yeah.
So it's funny how it traces back, and you can
none of this was covered in the movie Exodus, though.
Oh yes, I saw that many years ago. Paul Newman, the blue-eyed Paul Newman, heroically playing a Jew traveling to Palestine, and all of the movies, of course, portraying the Arabs as dirty and villainous, and again and again. And I was in that matrix for a little while, for years, until I finally started to wake up. My first encounter was with the John Birch Society and actually reading the book None Dare Call It Conspiracy in 1978. Mm-hmm. They, of course, never went into the Zionist component at all. So it was a few more years for me before I started to say, hey, this doesn't really add up, and how come we're not talking about this? And when I started to read books by William Guy Carr, who covered the same items as the John Birch Society before they had before the John Birch Society was founded, he would talk about the Zionists and the protocols and how all of this was coming true. And then I started to get the bigger picture. And you and I had a very good conversation about World War II. It was one of probably the longest broadcasts we ever did on the myths of the so-called Good War. Which it does. It takes, I think, 2.5 hours at least to vet that at any length. But I really enjoyed talking to you, Tim, because you have such a great perspective, and I know that's been enhanced by the many well-informed guests you've had on your program. And I, like I say, I always learn things from you when I'm on your show, things that you've researched or things that your guests have researched and brought to your attention.
Thank you. Well, anything else?
Yeah, I wanted to say one more thing about It's a Wonderful Life. Yeah. There was a story told I wanted to bring up. There was a dinner given for Jimmy Stewart when he was near the end of his life by Hollywood. And I looked for a televised a YouTube version of that. I couldn't find it, so I just referenced it in my article. And Dustin Hoffman actually broke down in tears when he talked about Stewart's performance in It's a Wonderful Life. But the best testimony, I thought, came from Telly Savalas, who played Kojak, the New York cop. Savalas had grown up in New York. He was very streetwise. And he said that when It's a Wonderful Life played, he and his friends went into the theater in their usual manner, which they sneaked in through the side entrance without paying. But when the movie was over, they were so overwhelmed that they went to the cashier and paid for their ticket price. In other words, it brought out their integrity. And what I wanted to say, Tim, was that films can actually serve a wonderful purpose. It's a Wonderful Life, and this is one of the reasons, again, they suppressed it. It just actually brings out your own integrity. It makes you think about your own life. It makes you think about the value of life. And actually, the arts, even though there's, for the most part, they're very damaging these days because of who runs Hollywood, It's actually possible for art to be very edifying and very enhancing to the human spirit. And that's one thing that It's a Wonderful Life really did. So I just wanted to end on that note. And, you know, there's nothing inherently wrong with the arts, with television, with film, with the graphic arts, with dance or music. All of those things can be used for the public good. Unfortunately, because of the power of money, they've been taken over by the forces of Lucifer for the most part. But it is actually possible, and we're trying to do this in our own way through the informational medium to bring truth to people, which is another way of enhancing the human spirit.
Excellent point. Yeah, a movie can actually uplift you and turn you into a better person and try to improve yourself as opposed to, corrupting you and smearing you or kind of sliming you. And then, you know, I guess people walking after seeing It's a Wonderful Life, you have a different feeling than, say, after watching Pulp Fiction.
So. Right, exactly. another example I gave in the article, the blog post, was A Christmas Carol. There's one version that I particularly like. It's the 1951 British version with Alastair Sim. It's a Wonderful Life, it makes me cry. There are scenes in there that I cry where he reviews his life and the things he's done to other people. And what I said in the article was, I think we all need to be Scrooged once in a while and take a hard look at our own life. And that's another film that I found to be uplifting, and I felt different after watching it. And it's another example of what the arts can achieve when they're used with the right motives.
Yeah, and a good example, a scene in It's a Wonderful Life, and you see the two different visions, is when George Bailey turns down the offer from Potter to be hired with a high salary and high standard of living. And, you know, he gives that speech, he calls him, you're nothing but a miserable little spider. You spin your webs, you think you can control everything. But I worry about the everyday people in your life. You don't think, you know, the rabble says, well, they do most of the living and dying in this town, and they do matter. And their character does matter. And it's kind of funny. Well, you know, he's criticizing George for handing out loans based on a man's character, where he's just looking at numbers and these things. Well, a character is a form of collateral, actually. And that's a tribute to small town banking, and you can operate on that small human scale and and ultimately a more humane and really productive level, because it's not just a question of dollars and cents, statistical growth and money and these things.
Yeah.
It's actually the well-being of the community. And although Potterville might have had greater GDP, you know, than what's the town there again?
Pottersville, yeah.
What's the other? You know, sorry, it's
Bedford Falls.
Bedford Falls, Bedford Falls, although it may be statistically poorer, is a happier place under the influence of George Bailey. And that's something we should think about when we hear about, you know, appeals to maximizing free trade and corporate efficiency and these things. And well, whether it's an issue of Walmart over the small mom and pop operations, these justifications for these large operations is lower prices every day. If there's a cost for those lower prices every day. It's the employees who don't make enough work there, so they have to go on SNAP cards, and therefore it's not as cheap as you think it is at the final analysis, nor the social cost or the cost to the community in general, the long-term cost of these things. And we see that sort of portrayed. I don't know if Frank Capra was consciously doing that in It's a Wonderful Life, but we do see the contrast there, the long-term results without sort of a humane limitation on on the business activities in these things. No, Bailey building loan isn't the most profitable, but it serves as an important function. And Potter's always trying to buy it out, and it's only through the character of George Bailey that prevents it from being bought out.
Right. Yeah, and it really seemed to embody the battle that's taking place today. Again, that's one of the reasons I believe it's suppressed today, is it is really about what is occurring in our world today. Are we going to be Bedford Falls? Are we going to be Pottersville? We've gone a long ways towards Pottersville.
Well, it's Mammon, right? Mammon, yeah. That's what it is. Yeah. Worship, are we going to worship Mammon?
Right. So. And which the Bible says is the source of all evil. There's it's been a great conversation, Tim, and I think we've touched on a lot of truths that are relevant to what's happening today. As you know, just as the Bible in its antiquity is relevant, we see that older films like It's a Wonderful Life also carry a forward a message to relevance to today.
Yeah, as they say, a timeless classic.
Yes. So yes, and I wish we had more of them. I'm always looking for them. Yeah, but there are a few out there. The chances they're being made, still being made, are dwindling.
No. Yeah. So okay, James. Thanks a lot.
Well, thank you, Tim. Congratulations again on your seventh child, right. And I want to wish you the best. And thank you for bringing so much truth to the American people, and honest conversation and good motives. Honesty and integrity. That's what it's all about. Just like George Bailey.
Oh well, you're certainly welcome. Thanks for that. So yeah, I'll let you go. I'll post this in a couple of days. I'll send you the link. So you'll get that. That's James Perloff, jamesperloff.com, author of Truth is the Lonely Warrior, and, of course, The Shadows of Power, expose of this Council on Foreign Relations. You can get those books, or guess what, at all, ironically, at Amazon, right?
You get them at Amazon. You should be able to, you know what, you could get them through bookstores, through CreateSpaces, expanded distribution, but CreateSpace was bought out by KDP, and I'm not sure if KDP is doing the same thing with expanded distribution. I'm not sure if you can get it at your bookstore yet, at least. I think they're still working on that aspect of it, but that's part of that merger consolidation we were talking about before, and it's got some glitches in it. So you can definitely get it on Amazon, though, or I'll go to my website and find out more.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Enjoy your evening. Thank you, Tim. God bless.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
When I get home from my job, I turn on my TV, but I can't keep my mind on the show. Oh, when I lay down at night, oh, I can't get no sleep, so I turn on my radio. But the only sound I hear is you whispering in my ear the words that you used to say. Oh, the days are getting longer, my love grows stronger, and the fever's burning hotter, baby. I got the fever for your love. Yeah. Well, ain't nothing this poor boy can do, and I got the fever for your love. Yeah. You left this little boy blue. I can remember coming home. I see you standing at the store, dishes all on the table, but you're ready to go. Man, you're on out to a movie show, something that you wanna see. Now, darling, you were my sun in the morning, you were my moon at night. When I think about you, baby, I feel alright. The days get longer, my love grows stronger, and the fever's burning hotter, baby. I got the fever for your love, yeah. Well, ain't nothing this poor boy can do when I got the fever for your love, yeah. You know you left this little boy blue. But coming home, I see you standing at the store, dishes out on the table, but you're ready to go. Maybe on out to a movie show, something that we wanna see. Now, darling, you were my sun in the morning, you were my moon at night. When I think about you, baby, I feel alright. The days get longer, oh, my love grows stronger, and the fever's burning hotter, baby. Fever for your love, yeah. But ain't nothing this poor boy can do when I got the fever for your love, yeah. You know you left this little boy blue.